Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show and download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. Visit their website at isaac1.org. That's ISIC1.org. Use their friendly medical library that translates medical journals for public understanding. Listen to their free speaker series and follow the science on marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a pot conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Pot as in, hey, it's just pot. I want to reflect on patients in the emergency department who have various complaints, but their drug use is often ignored as the root cause of the problem. That happens with patients with all sorts of drugs, but for some reason, pot gets dismissed the most. I've observed this phenomenon in medicine over the years. We don't like to confront patients when they have unhealthy habits, especially drug use. And when we do not confront patients, we fail in two ways. One, we fail to give patients an opportunity to make a connection between their drug use and health. And two, we fail in the opportunity for them to change and improve their lives. It's risky to confront patients. They may get mad, give you bad reviews, complain, and leave your practice. But I've learned it's a risk worth taking. And it's an important part of healing. I take that risk in every patient when I have the opportunity. I treated a woman who had a rapid atrial fibrillation. It's an erratic heart rate that needs cardioversion. A shock to the heart is what she needed to fix her rhythm. Our team delivered that electricity with some sedation and voila, fixed her problem. Her heart was beating regularly. Easy peasy in terms of medical care. But this woman also had a strong odor of marijuana on her clothes that I could smell through my N95 mask. She was bewildered of why this rhythm kept happening to her, although she took her heart medications. Many doctors may just be quiet and ignore the association of marijuana and her cardiac emergency. But I took the risk of having a difficult conversation. I told her that marijuana is affecting her heart. I explained that the American Heart Association has a warning about marijuana and heart health. She could have yelled at me, "How dare I judge her cannabis use?" But her eyes were opened wide as I spoke with her, and I could tell she took it to heart, pun intended. I told her addiction is real, not easy to quit, and she may have withdrawal, which was also worth the effort. She was extremely thankful and grateful. No one ever told her that before. I take the risk and have the same type of conversation with patients with cannabis hyperemesis syndrome or scromiting, psychosis and mania, dizziness, depression, agitation, stroke-like symptoms, and anxiety, all potentially caused by marijuana. I ask patients to take a cleanse and see if they feel differently after 2 weeks of withdrawal and then a period without drugs. Prevention in healthcare is important. It doesn't take a lot of time to have that conversation. We do that for eating healthy and for exercising, and I add that drug prevention message in regular patient care. If kids under the age of 25 are using, I mentioned the growing brain. And older patients who use marijuana, I have them check their prescription medications for interactions with cannabis, THC, or cannabidiol, CBD, so they're informed. If parents use, I warn about pediatric poisoning and the importance of locking up marijuana, like locking up opioid prescriptions. If drivers are using, I mention the 4.5-hour rule for waiting after smoking before driving, and even longer for edibles. I learned from history. At the peak of the opioid prescription epidemic, doctors were reluctant to say anything when they saw their patients were doctor shopping or taking too many opioids. They didn't want a fight or a bad Yelp review. And what happened? People died. When you stay silent, that's a deadly consequence. Understanding that people could die motivated me to warn patients, even have difficult conversations, as it was important to have that intervention. So I learned how to say no nicely. Some patients were angry. One or two complained about me to administration, but many, many were very thankful because no one ever told them that. I learned that taking the risk of a difficult conversation is worth it. It could change someone's life. It could even save a life. What about marijuana? Is it just pot? Or should we have the important and sometimes difficult conversations when we see harms of drug use? I think it's important to speak up for both individuals at risk and for public health policies. To learn more about pot, I reached out to Aubrey Adams, who hosts her own podcast called It's Just Pot. What's the problem? Aubrey Adams is founder and director of Every Brain Matters, a nationally trusted educational resource formed by families with loved ones whose lives were damaged or killed by marijuana. Aubrey transformed her life with the power of a mother out to protect her child. She took her trauma as a mom, whose child had cannabis-induced psychosis, and became a national expert, advocate, and source of assistance for families who struggle. To learn more about Aubrey Adams and Every Brain Matters, check out the High Truth show notes. Aubrey Adams, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Lev. This is exciting to be here.
It is. We've known each other for a very, very long time. I know that I could always count on you to connect me with people and families, and you're my moral compass when it comes to the issues of drugs and specifically marijuana. You're an amazing advocate that gets things done and connects with people, and it all comes from a personal place. Could you mind sharing that with us?
Yeah, thank you for giving me this opportunity to share with you. And I feel the same about you, Dr. Lev. I am your fan. I'm very proud of the work you do. When it comes to families like mine, when we see a professional like you speaking out about the harms of marijuana, we feel supported. We feel validated, and we feel like we have a great voice spreading this education. So thank you. My story started in Pueblo, Colorado, which is what I call ground zero for the marijuana expansion movement. And when the legalization happened, I did not realize how it would harm my family, but it surely did. My son became addicted, and then he was having an episode of psychosis. I did not realize what was happening. He was irrational, paranoid. He was repeating things that didn't make sense over and over again. I was trying to talk to him, but he couldn't comprehend what I was trying to help him with. He became violent. One night he became so violent, my younger son ran barefoot through the snow to get away from him. And that night my son tried to take his life. We're grateful that he survived, but it started a cycle of addiction and episodes of psychosis. And he was hospitalized twice in a psychiatric unit. And when he came out of the second hospital, I said, you know, what is going on? I don't understand. And he said he was smoking really strong marijuana, and he called it crack weed. And then he said they were dabs. And I had no clue what a dab was. So I became educated at that point. I knew how to read scientific studies somewhat with my background in the medical field too. I worked in the physical therapy world for 20 years. And I got angry when I realized what was happening. I realized that dabs are high concentrations of THC, very toxic, very potent, very mind-destroying drug, especially for youth. And so I became an advocate at that point. In the meantime, we were cycling in and out of addiction. I couldn't find help for him because insurance companies do not treat for cannabis use disorder. But my friend was a social worker with the Department of DSS and said, as a taxpayer in Colorado, you can volunteer your family for crisis intervention with the Department of Social Services. So I did that and we got some help for a while, but the what I call the pediatric disease of addiction had set in my son's brain. So his brain was craving the drug. He wanted to change the way he felt. And he even progressed to meth and heroin for a short period of time, but a significant amount of time. And he ended up, through this long story, going to two residential treatment programs. And after that, I realized I could not, there was just not a good support system, resources in the state of Colorado that would really support his mental well-being. So I found a place in Houston, Texas. Houston is kind of ground zero for the youth recovery movement. They have alternative peer groups. They have recovery high school here. And I got connected with the professionals down here. I learned about a community called Cornerstone. And so I brought him here. And he became what they call a winner in the program. He achieved 3 years of sobriety. He was helping other families. He was sponsoring. He was helping me learn about recovery. In the meantime, my husband was deteriorating. I did not know because my main focus was on my oldest son. But my husband thought marijuana was medicine. He's reading articles about it, how it helps PTSD. And he was very suicidal, very depressed. And then he started hearing voices. So
at what age?
This was a very hard moment in my life. My husband at the time, this was 2016, and he is 52 now. So let me do the math real quick.
Well, that's a red flag. A 52-year-old man doesn't just get psychosis and hears voices out of nowhere, right? That is an external event that's reversible usually, if we get to the source of the problem.
Yes, and thank God his work put him on probation. They suspended him from his job. And they told him, you got to be drug free to have this job. And so that was the driving factor for him to get help.
I've seen that a lot. And even with my extended family, that people have used marijuana forever and it's fine and it's good and it's not a problem. And then they end up in the emergency department in psychosis. And if somebody doesn't make the connection, like, you have a reversible mental health crisis. If nobody says to them, this is because of marijuana, then they'll go on and think that it's something else and, you know, keep going to doctors or be labeled with a permanent mental health condition. But if at the core we figure out, wait, this is from an external source, right? It could be marijuana. It could be from your steroids, but it's not your underlying innate mental health. So it's fixable.
Correct. And he was never on pharmaceutical drugs prior to his marijuana use, but he requires 4 to be stabilized right now. And, you know, I ended up being separated from him for 8 years. And here's the kicker with my story. Here's kind of the silver lining. We have been separated for 8 years. I took the kids to Houston. I dove into this recovery community. I surrounded myself with recovery. And he's doing well now. He's been THC free for at least 3 years and he's doing great. And we're back together and I'm going back to Colorado to work on our marriage again. So it's pretty incredible in that regard. But I agree with you. I agree that if we had the medical community backing up, like you need to remove the THC from your system, detox off it, get the support you need, you will get better. You know, you will get better.
Yeah, especially as an older adult. The problem is with teens and young adults, if you continue doing that and don't take out this exogenous source on your brain, then it can become permanent. And then we're committing these young people to a lifelong mental health challenge that's not reversible.
Well, and I have to share with you, I know this is further down my story, but I run support groups for family members that have loved ones with marijuana addiction. And I can tell you that this permanent psychosis is happening in adults too. I am in touch with many families that maybe the husband was kind of a marijuana user here and there throughout their life, and they got a hold of this, what I call industrialized marijuana, the high concentration, and now they're schizophrenic.
Right. Yeah, it's devastating. But I love hearing the power of being a mom, you know, where you don't give up on your kid, you know, in the worst moment, you know, where your son has this, you know, violent episode, leaving your other child running in the snow. You figured out a way, you researched the whole world, and got him out of Colorado to Houston to recovery, changed your entire life around to save your child. And I'm always inspired by the power of being a mother.
That is true. I got really serious that I realized that my son's life, his mental well-being, was at stake. And I needed to do everything I could to get in the way of his marijuana use or any drug use, any self-destructive behavior that he was having. But when I read the research about the pathway to permanent psychosis, I got very serious and I got very focused and knew that as his mom, I need to provide the healthiest environment with the best boundaries around him that I could.
And I'm really happy that your story has a happy ending because, you know, sadly, we know many families that they continue to struggle or have a permanent loss.
I can tell you that my son is—he is not out of the woods, is what I would say. He's not the same he's ever been. After the 3 years of sobriety, he decided he wanted to use again, and that was just devastating because I thought at that point he really understood what marijuana did to his brain. He has very high anxiety, but he went back out and he relapsed, and we didn't see him for 2.5 years.
Oh.
That was this. I mean, everything about the disease of addiction is hard, but watching him do that, knowing I had no control over it, made me grow a lot. And I dove deeper into my own recovery program. And I think that's one thing that parents don't understand when they're going through this with a loved one, with a child. The best thing they can do is start working their own recovery program because it'll teach them everything, a lot about the disease of addiction, the behaviors that come with it, and what they can and they can't control. And then the healthier the parents get, the greater the chance the child has to recover long term.
And expand about that. Does that mean the parent doesn't have an addiction? You mean those parents just to learn more about the disease of addiction, the relapsing nature, like you just mentioned that you experienced with your son when you thought he was good, 3 years sober, then the disease relapses?
So parents play a huge role, and maybe we don't have the addiction to the drug, but some people call it codependency. Some people call it a second addiction. I think there's a book called Second Addiction. I want to read that. But we play a key role in a 12-step program, for example. There's the 3 C's. We learn as parents we didn't cause it, meaning we didn't cause the disease, we didn't cause the addiction. We can't control it, and we can't cure it. But the 4C is we can contribute to it, and we need to figure out to contribute to it positively or negatively. And we get blind spots in the contribution part of it. So going to recovery meetings, getting a sponsor, and working our own program, meaning we are working the 12-step program, those blind spots become clear, our boundaries become clear, and we find more peace in the process. And the more peaceful we are, the more healthy we are, the better we can show up for our loved ones and not be so reactive, but respond appropriately to their behaviors of self-destruction. And it's a lot to learn. So I started working the 12 steps since 2016, And I will work them for the rest of my life because they work for me. They give me a variety of tools that I can turn to when I'm struggling. And they give me a whole community of peers, my peers, that I can lean on. And I can pick up the phone and call and say, oh, I'm just so struggling. I'm so upset. And I can talk it through with them. And it's such a key thing in this disease because there's two reasons why like a person or a child will get into long-term recovery. One is they got to have sober, healthy peers and a healthy family dynamics. And we just never talk about the parents. Like, what do the parents need to do to positively contribute to whatever the child's going through with the disease of addiction? But we need our healthy peers. We don't need to surround ourselves with peers that are parent shaming us, that are blaming us, that are accusing us of all kinds of things. We need to be able to surround ourselves with those healthy adults that have walked this road before us and we can learn from. So I only hang out with parents that are pretty much in recovery. I mean, I don't exclude anybody else, but when I go do social events or something, I want to do like recovery centered social events.
That's fascinating. So parents themselves who don't have a substance use disorder are doing this 12-step program for themselves so they could be better parents and support for their children.
That is correct. That sums it up in a nutshell. We take the focus off the child and the disease, and we put the focus on ourselves and how we can take care of ourselves through this process, which makes us healthier.
Now, is this a different 12? This is not the 12-step program that have patients in the emergency department who come in drunk and they, okay, well, I'm going to go back to some meeting. Is this a different special type of meeting?
So the 12 steps are the 12 steps no matter what fellowship you go to. But like Al-Anon was developed for family members that have loved ones with alcoholism. Nar-Anon is for people that have loved ones with drug problems. And we have now Mar-Anon, which is for people that have loved ones with marijuana problems. So technically the 12 steps are the same for the user or the family member. We just kind of look at it different ways. So the user is looking at it as, I thought the drug was my solution, but it wasn't. And then we look at mostly the parents, we work the 12 steps, so we're not trying to control the user and trying to shame them into doing what we want them to do, because we want them to stop using the drugs. We want them to be healthy, and we really have no control over that.
Wow, that's powerful. So anybody who's listening, who's facing this as a family member who wants to help somebody, that's the resources. And again, Mar-Anon. And you have several thousand members and meetings on this, right? I mean, this is a huge need.
Yeah, we do. And I realized I used to go to Al-Anon meetings and I would show up and I would start talking about my son's marijuana problem and people would laugh at me. And so I didn't feel welcome in some of those meetings. And so I developed Every Brain Matters and started having support meetings there. And then my friend Bart Bright told me about, hey, do you know about Mar-Anon? I was like, yeah, I didn't know about Mar-Anon. I was like, what's Mar-Anon? And he's like, it's like Al-Anon, but for people that have loved ones with marijuana problems. I'm like, oh, brilliant. Because at that point, I was a host mom for youth in recovery. I was working a 12-step program. I'm like, Bart, I go, we got to develop this. So Mar-Anon was in existence, but it wasn't active. So the lady who had built the website said, here you go. Here's the website. Do what you want. So Bart and I started having meetings, and this was all during COVID. And we started with two meetings a week. And now I want to say there's like 13 meetings a week. It's amazing. So,
wow.
But I do run a meeting every Saturday morning. It's specifically for family members that have a loved one with cannabis use disorder or the addiction to marijuana, or have cannabis-induced psychosis. So Mar-Anon is specialized. You know, marijuana is different from the other drugs. We have the CIP, the cannabis-induced psychosis. We have the CHS, the cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome. And there's different behaviors and different responses the parents need depending on what their loved one or their child's going through. So it's we have really provided a great connection. And I draw my strength from those groups. And I will be going to meetings for the rest of my life because I need to, because I am a codependent. I do want to fix things. I do want to control things, but I know the only person I can control and fix is me. And so it's a great way for me to stay healthy mentally.
That's great. And shout out to Bart Bright, who's both of our friends. I'm really inspired by his outreach as well. Every Brain Matters. Tell me about that.
So Every Brain Matters was inspired by me, by Dr. Christine Miller, when we were doing a rally to oppose the legalization of marijuana in Sacramento, California, way back in 2016. And she was educating me a lot about the brain. She is just amazing. And I was just absorbing it all because I just couldn't believe what I was going through with my family. And she said to me at some point, she goes, "Well, you know, Aubrey, every brain matters." And I was like, "That is so true, because what happens in the brain predicts the behaviors, right?" And then we were seeing the increase in violence, homelessness, all this stuff was happening. And I'm like, what is our country doing to our people? You know, why are they increasing accessibility to this drug? And not only are they increasing accessibility to marijuana, but they've changed it. They've made it more potent. They made it more accessible. And they've covered it with sugary flavors to mask how foul it would really taste if they just consumed it. So I had this dream of developing an organization called Every Brain Matters. And it took me a few years to find a logo that I loved. But my friend Julie Schauer was like, "Aubrey, when I found that logo," she's like, "go for it. Go ahead and develop it." I'm like, "Yes." And the purpose of developing Every Brain Matters was to get parents to speak up and advocate and say, these policies are harming our families. But I realized the families that were coming forward needed support. They just couldn't come up to the table and start advocating. They needed support. They needed resources and recovery. They needed a place to kind of land, like a safe place to land and be connected to other families. So Every Brain Matters has two arms. It has a support arm and an advocacy arm. So we can support whoever wants to have those resources and find hope and healing. And then the ones that want to bridge over to advocacy, we support them in that too, and give a voice to them through our podcast, our YouTube channel, through written testimonies, connecting them with legislators or other organizations that need their voice to show the true impacts of marijuana. So our latest campaign, we almost have it ready to go, is called the Voices of Marijuana Harms. And it's great because, I mean, it's kind of sad, but it's great because it's going to really expose what's happening to thousands, if not millions, of families across the world.
Yeah. And you give them a voice and you give them each other to realize that they're not alone. It's interesting listening to you talk about, there's a huge movement in America about the stigma campaign, eliminating the stigma for drugs, you know, whether it's and for addiction. But yet somehow you still get the stigma, and you've expressed it well. If your child or if you have a cannabis use disorder, then somehow you still get the stigma, and you have to find your own space within the addiction world to support you through that difficulty.
Oh, that is so true. We are not taken seriously in a lot of recovery circles, but unfortunately, many families are being harmed. So that stigma is slowly, you know.
And it's not justified, because if we got the data, I see this every day. I ask every single patient with a substance use disorder about their journey to drugs. And 90% of the time, if not more, it starts with marijuana at a very young age, 9, 10, 11. And like you said, a pediatric disease. And, you know, and now they're, you know, 25 or 30, and they even forgot about the whole weed thing. It's like, oh, well, that's just weed. Now they're into, you know, methamphetamine and fentanyl. They forgot that, well, it all started with marijuana when they were very young. And that's important. And I point it out to my patients because I tell them their brain has been used to drugs now for you know, 20 years. You're not going to be able to fix that with one dose of Suboxone or 1 week of Suboxone. It's going to take time, a lot more time than that. And that's helpful to in having people understand that.
Yeah, that's a great point.
I want to talk a little bit about things in the news and in the media. And top of that media is that you were on the Dr. Phil show. I was, I think, on his very first show where he talked about marijuana. But now he's coming in with a series and his own program. Tell me about your recording.
Yeah, so this show that we recorded with Dr. Phil will be on cannabis-induced psychosis. And it really does expose the harms. There's two families that they feature, the Backuses and the Wolves. And I'll tell you what, there wasn't a dry eye in the place. It was incredible. It was just inspiring. And I just sat back in awe to watch these families come forward and tell their stories and to see their courage and to know that they're doing this like, it's too late for their families, but they want to raise awareness so other families are aware. So other families are more prepared to respond to any symptoms that might be coming on for cannabis-induced psychosis. It was really good. And Dr. Phil, I think, really understands the issue, and he's willing to provide that education. And of course, they put me on to battle a marijuana industry person. So that's a little uncomfortable, but I'm happy to do that.
Right. You're not a professional debater, but you're learning.
Yes.
All right. Yeah, so that's great. So we'll be looking out for that Dr. Phil program. I can't wait to watch it. I think it's important. And he's got a great reach. So kudos for him for reaching out because you know, with your stories and the families who are reaching out and his platform, then maybe that's the way to get to the answer of things. You know, I just have to always think about my last shift. I worked last night and we have a PERT team. It's a group of like social worker, mental health workers who go out sometimes instead of law enforcement to 911 calls where it's a mental health issue. And they brought in this patient who I was living in his apartment, but they said it's not livable. It was full of maggots and debris, and the kitchen's not usable. It's just an absolute mess. And they said he cannot go back to this situation. And so it's kind of a, you know, social welfare. And I'm, you know, okay, I figured, you know, I'll deal with that. And then only at the other end, and like as a side, they go, oh, and he uses marijuana regularly. And it's like, why is that? That's huge. And talking to the patient, it's like, well, I'm really trying to, I said, well, your place is a mess. You can't go back there because he really wanted to just go home. He goes, well, I'm trying to get my life together again. Well, if nobody tells him or points out that he won't be able to do that while he's, you know, flooding his brain with weed, that and that's, you know, part of the problem, then he'll never get better. And I said that to the mental health worker, saying like, hey, you just mentioned that as a side. And I pointed it out and I showed him a story that Jim Avala just did. He's doing a 4-part series where he's showing cannabis-induced psychosis and the transformation that people have had. And they said, yeah, you're right. We see this all the time. So we're seeing it all the time. We're just not making the association. And so, they were like, okay, I'm gonna share this with our whole team. So,
yeah, and that was I saw the first two pieces that featured you and Jim's reports, wonderful reports, and I think you make a very good point too, because marijuana users, not all of them, but some of them that really have the mental deterioration, they kind of lose their humanity and their self-worth, and they quit taking care of themselves. They don't even have basic hygiene, and and know like to clean up around themselves. When I hosted youth in recovery in my home, most of them had marijuana problems. Some had cannabis-induced psychosis. And some of the rules I had in my home was like, you will shower every day. You know, we're going to go back to the basics where you're going to clean up after yourself. And I would, if they wouldn't do it, then I would have hold them accountable. I'd have to have some kind of consequence, not a punishment, but some kind of consequence to help hold them accountable so they could wake up from that fog of pumping all the weed in their brain for whatever period of time that was. So I understand what you're saying there.
Yeah. Other things in the news recently making headlines. I don't know why it was just recently, because the letter from the Department of Health and Human Services is dated August 29th, 2023, from Dr. Rachel Levine, who is on this show. And it's a letter for the DEA administrator and Milgram saying that marijuana should be rescheduled. And many people were like really raising their eyebrows. I've heard various comments on that, like this is political, not scientific, it's bad data. And I'm thinking the FDA and the whole integrity of the medical community would collapse if we don't follow the science and have consumer protections. And the other thing I realized from all this is that if you're looking at bad data, you're going to have bad recommendations. The government is not working in the emergency department. And I know, because I was part of government. And when we would make political decisions, I'd say, okay, who here actually took care of a case of cannabis-induced psychosis or an overdose or anything that we were talking about? And nobody has done that. They're just looking at statistics. Yet, cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, and I know, you know, you and I have been on the forefront of educating about that. That is still not a code for the emergency departments to say, so the government would know that this is a problem. That still does not exist. Now we're like 10 years into this disease. And that's how long it takes them to even code or quantify. So when they say, oh, well, we don't have deaths from marijuana, or we don't have as many emergency department visits, it's because in my coding, I'll say vomiting and abdominal pain, because I don't have a code for cannabis hyperemesis syndrome. All right. So I don't know, but what are your advocates and families thinking about that?
Well, we are, as a family members, we are extremely disappointed in our government. We are HHS, the FDA, I find their drive to reschedule marijuana reckless. I find it at a level of incompetency. The government is supposed to protect the health and safety of its citizens, and they are stripping that away from our families. So I find it a very sad time in our country that they don't understand, like you said, they're not even collecting the data, and they're allowing politics to drive this instead of science. It's kind of a scary time in our country. And I'm hoping that they don't allow this to happen, because I don't know of another drug that can really do such mass destruction as marijuana. I think the mental deterioration that it brings to people is just deteriorating our country in general. It's making our schools and our neighborhoods unsafe. And for them to put a stamp of approval kind of on marijuana is reckless and incompetent.
Yeah. Well said. What do you say to people who say, well, it's better than alcohol, which is one of the talking points of the industry?
Yeah, that's one of the talking points I like to talk about, because it's not less harmful than alcohol. We don't, like you said before, we don't collect the data on deaths associated with marijuana, but we're talking about a water-soluble drug, which is alcohol, comparing it to a fat-soluble drug, which is marijuana. And the general public doesn't understand that those fat-soluble drugs adhere to our fats in our body, and our fattiest organ is our brain. That's why we have such devastating effects on the mental well-being of that individual. And I testified in Ohio, even after they legalized marijuana, but I was testifying in front of a Senate committee. And I said, you know, one of the biggest deceptions of the marijuana, the predatory addiction for profit marijuana industry, is that they compare this to alcohol, but one swallow of alcohol will not induce psychotic symptoms as one swallow of an edible will, or a couple hits off a potent THC vape will, mm-hmm. or two hits off a bong, like it happened to Brent Spacer in Thousand Oaks, California. So they're deceiving the American public by comparing it to alcohol. And we must not have drug biases. We must understand the harmful effects of every drug and be able to educate truthfully about that and empower people to make great decisions around that. And it's just, you know, addiction economics. This predatory addiction for profit marijuana industry wants to make money. So they want to deceive the users and not tell them the truth.
Yeah. I think we need to start saying that marijuana is way worse than alcohol. If your kid gets drunk one time and, you know, that's not good. That's not healthy. If they don't get behind a car or die in some type of accident, they'll probably be okay. But same kid may get high, and the chances of them now going into psychosis or permanent psychosis, you don't have that risk with alcohol.
Correct.
And yet you still have the same risk as far as accidents or car accidents. So, yeah, I think it's worse. You mentioned Bryn Spacer, a young woman who took a couple hits of her boyfriend's bong, Chad Amelia, and had the worst violent cannabis-induced psychosis, stabbing her boyfriend 108 times, her dog and herself, to the point where she needed surgery on her own neck. And she kept going and going and going. And part of this was caught on police camera. She did not stop when police came in. She continued and didn't stop until they hit her multiple times. They could have killed her with a gun if they, you know, if they didn't. Frankly, if she was not like a smaller person, they felt like they could handle this because they walked into a bloodbath. And now she's a normal person, testified. She was convicted of involuntary manslaughter. And the controversy now in the news is that the judge gave her 100 hours of community service, and that led to very provocative comments, you know, that I read regarding this article. Some people say, well, that's crazy. That can't be true. Nobody gets that sick from marijuana. Some people said if she was a man, she would be in jail, you know, that it's because she's a cute girl. Some people say this is a license to kill if you can, you know, use drugs. And my favorite statement is the people who needs to be in jail for murder are the legislator, the governor, and the industry that failed to warn the public and to have public health protections.
Oh, yeah, I kind of agree with that. I mean, you know, we all play a part in this issue, but the governor of California and the legislators play a huge part, not even to put warning labels on the products. I mean, that's incompetent. I mean, every job I've ever worked my whole life, if I was that incompetent, I get fired. You know, it's just... It's ridiculous, or at least written up or reprimanded or something. But I think this Brent Spacer trial is historic and really shows why marijuana should never be promoted. I know that making it illegal is probably impossible, but it really does show that the unpredictable nature of this drug and how it can lead to murder, how it can lead to violence just from one use. That's not a drug you need to be promoting as a recreational drug or even calling it medicine. I wonder what's going to happen. I mean, I know we have a lot of corruption and we don't have our elected leaders are not getting along very well either. So there's never like any common ground anymore. It's a very radical driven point of view. It seems like those people get the airways. But if we just, like you said, follow the science, I do have hope for the country, but it really does demonstrate why this drug should not be promoted.
Yeah. And the failure of consumer protections, right? Alcohol has great consumer protections. Tobacco took a while, but there are, you know, great campaigns, and it's not cool to smoke now. Our cigarette smoking rate now is like 11% the peak in 1963, it was like 42%. So tobacco is uncool, and sadly, we've replaced it with even worse things.
Yeah, yeah. And I hope Brent Spacer and the Chad O'Melia family file even more lawsuits moving forward to hold the other people that play a part in this accountable. I don't know what will happen, but yeah, we did. We don't have any consumer protection on the marijuana. We just have all these propaganda campaigns everywhere about it. All these right. False dichotomies. Yeah.
And what strikes me also is that Brin's case is, you know, it is historic, and we're making it historic, but it's not rare. You know, this was a trial, so we were able to see that she had only cannabis and no other drugs, and there was a dramatic case, and so it's very clear cut. But really, every day in the emergency department, I see like the families that you work with have cannabis-induced psychosis, and it maybe didn't end up, you know, with 108 stabbings, but it could be violent. I think the same week I learned about Brin, I took care of a woman who was slicing her neck and her body because the voices told her she needed to do that in order to save her boyfriend, and she followed those orders.
And I'm in the same boat with you, Dr. Lev. Every day I'm talking to new families. They refer people to me that are in crisis, that have loved one with cannabis-induced psychosis. And the family's like, what do we do? We have no clue what to do. I took one phone call this morning. A young man who had multiple psychotic breaks got into recovery, but was eventually diagnosed with schizophrenia, but decided for some reason he was going to smoke weed again. And he's totally psychotic, delusional, accusing family members of horrific things. And they're like, we're afraid this is going to affect our job. He's out there saying this on social media and accusing us of things we didn't do. And then I have the rest of my day, I have two more families I'm scheduled to speak to about their loved ones with cannabis-induced psychosis too. So I get on the phone with them and hopefully like give them two or three resources where they can start to kind of walk through this crisis. So it's the individual and it's the families too that are affected. And every day I get either a new message or a new phone call. And I just published a story on Every Brain Matters. I'm not going to mention his name because he shared a very impactful story. He's a veteran from Afghanistan. And when he smoked marijuana, it like put him back where he thought he was in Afghanistan and he was in hell. And he got a gun and he shot his girlfriend and both of his dogs. And he found himself in his driveway with the red dots on his chest where the police were going to kill him with the gun in his hand. And he got on the phone with his girlfriend's mother. And for some reason, he dropped the gun and he survived. Thank God the girlfriend survived and only one of the dogs survived. The other one passed away. But this happened a year ago to him, and he's still trying to figure out how to recover from this. You know, how does he accept and forgive himself for what he did? So he's contacted Every Brain Matters and said, I think I need to use my voice. But then when he comes forward and he uses his voice, then he's reliving it again and he's re-traumatized again. So he let me do his written story. And then he said, well, I might do a video interview with you. But I've had two states reach out to me since I published his story. I think it was on Wednesday I published his story. They want him to come to the states and testify in front of the legislator. And so now I need to approach him and say, do you think you can do this? You know, can you come forward in front of a body of people and tell your story and try to stop these reckless policies that these states are passing? And he has to put his mental well-being first before he decides whether he does that again, if he wants to keep reliving this over and over again. So it's hard. Yeah. It's hard.
I hope you could help him And there's an art that you have mastered of helping patients and families in crisis. And because I'm sure it takes a personal toll on you, but hopefully you get strength from that as well, because you're helping so many people.
I sure do.
Legislation, we've seen a lot of failures. The farm bill and the intent of legalizing hemp has now legalized all these Delta products that have never been tested in rats, and they're being tested for the first time on our children. California's, frankly, failures in labels and candies and even labels on prescriptions we want. Tell us in your experience where you've seen successes. Where are some role models, something positive?
Oh boy, I haven't seen much success with the hemp. Are you asking about the hemp policy?
Any type of legislation now that is, protects the public, from any type of marijuana, like THC potency limits or limiting advertising on children or anything like that.
Well, I've seen Vermont put a potency limit on, and right now what's happening in Vermont is they're trying to take that away. They want full 99% THC. So the small group of professionals there are combating that, and they had called me to help them a little bit too with that. And I haven't seen much successes, Dr. Lim. I got to tell you, I hate to be negative, but I haven't seen much pushback in that. I think Colorado did ban Delta 8 THC, but I'm not sure about the other variants. When I testified in Ohio, Jay LeBlanc, who is a great advisor of mine, and I know he advises a lot of people on the hemp issue, he made language for the Ohio bill that would get rid of all those synthetic THC hemp products out of their marijuana legalization bill, and they denied it. And I just don't understand why they would do that. If they want, they say marijuana is natural, but then they don't want to ban the synthetic products. I just don't get it. I can tell you where I'm at in Texas now, it is out of control. I'm working with a doctor here who's talking to legislators to try to outlaw all the THC hemp variants products that are pretty much on every corner in Texas. Every strip mall has a smoke or a vape shop. And I tell parents and I educate people that technically marijuana is legal in the state of Texas, and they don't believe me. Well, and then I take them into one of these smoke shops and I show them. And I show them the difference between a Delta 9 THC products and a Delta 8 or a Delta 10 product. And what one of the family members I spoke to, what we have come to the conclusion is THC is THC is THC. There, it's addictive chemical, it causes psychosis, and it is toxic. And you will have the same reactions from a Delta 9 THC product that you can have from a Delta 8 THC product. And what's more devastating about this loophole in our 2018 Farm Bill with these Delta THC product variants is that most of them are put in candies with sugary flavors. Most of them are put in vapes with sugary flavors to mask how foul and toxic they truly are. And that is a deception, because I really feel that kids or anybody who would put that vape to their mouth and toke on it, if it wasn't for that sugary flavor, they would spit it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, and you know, for a country that's obsessed with consumer protections, you see labels on everything from your food to your mattress to your golf balls to watching a TV with flashing lights, a movie. We ignore that completely when it comes to drugs that are being sold again at the mall.
Yeah. We don't understand. Bluebell ice cream is a big thing in Texas, and there was a few people harmed, maybe like 11 people harmed, and they pulled all the Bluebell ice cream from the shelf in Texas, all of it. Yeah. I mean, it was all over the news. don't consume this, pull it, you know, can harm you. But when it comes to these THC hemp products.
Right. But here's some Delta 8 that was never tested on anybody. It's like the new synthetic product that people have died from. And yet you could just buy it because of loophole regulations. It's amazing that we haven't closed that. Yes. What do you want the public to know?
I want the public to know that these marijuana policies are reckless, and families can't compete against this powerful industry. We're finding ways to compete, but also families are unprepared with resources and education to prevent, manage, or even recover from cannabis addiction or psychosis or hyperemesis. And these families are in crisis, and they're losing their loved ones. Not necessarily all of them are dying, but they're losing their humanity. And that this time in our country, this new era of industrialized marijuana, I think there's going to be a day when we look back and say, what did we do? What did we do? The mass destruction, the silent crisis that we're living in here was all preventable. And because of the lack, the incompetence of our government, they are allowing a lot of people to be harmed. And to me, that's devastating. But what I want to do as an advocate, as the director of Every Brain Matters, is I want to bring hope back into the conversation. So regardless of what the culture is doing, what the policymakers are doing, I want to continue to grow our network, our community of resources, of empowerment, to teach families how to draw those boundaries, how to get help, how to get support, so they can survive this crisis. Because we are capable of surviving it. We just got to keep increasing the education, increasing the resources to recover, and link arms together and have a collective voice on this issue.
Thank you. And I really want to promote you, Aubrey. Every Brain Matters. What a great resource to anybody who is struggling out there, family members. That's a great resource to go to. Aubrey, you put out the very first brochure on cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, I think 2 years before I had one that was, you know, automatically in the computer at our hospital. We would see patients with cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, and I'd have nothing to give them, and I used the brochure that you created. So resources that are, again, way ahead of the medical community and getting on board of understanding what this disease is. Promote Marinon for families who are struggling as well, and your podcast. And I love the names that you come up with. Like, Every Brain Matters is so creative. And also, It's Just Pot. What's the problem? I love that as well.
Thank you so very much.
And thank you so much. Thank you, Aubrey, for your for helping, the kindness, the empathy that I know takes a toll on you, but you give and you don't stop. I love that resiliency. Again, you and the families that you work with are the reason I do what I do, and I can't thank you enough.
We can't thank you enough either. We are your fan. We appreciate you and everything you're doing. Keep up the great work.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors educating on the harms of marijuana. Visit isaac1.org. That's ISIC1.org. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.